and welcome to another edition of Drug Fix, the Pink Sheet's Pharma Regulatory Podcast. I'm Derek Ingery, an executive editor at the Pink Sheet, and I'm joined by senior editor Kathy Kelly, managing editor Bridget Silverman, and editor-in-chief Nielsen Hobbs. Today is April 19th, 2024. We're going to dive in today with a topic we don't talk about enough here, Medicare spending. Kathy, you wrote about CMS's spending estimate for the Alzheimer's drug Leqembi. The initial reaction to the number was a surprise, but now it seems like people are wondering if it's even correct.
Yeah, it was a surprise. So this estimate from CMS apparently came out during a call in late February that the agency had with commercial insurance actuaries. The purpose of the call was to prepare for the upcoming Medicare plan bids. So CMS was interacting to try to answer questions and that sort of thing. They did get a question on forecast for Leqembi, and they came out with numbers that really are a lot higher than what Eisai, the marketer of the drug, has been talking about. The sort of top line number was $3.5 billion in Medicare spending in 2025. You know, that estimate is nearly three times the estimate that Eisai provided in a, I think it was an early March report on Leqembi, and they were estimating sales of $1.3 billion in North and South America combined in 2026. So there was a lot of, you know, surprise and questions about how CMS came up with that estimate. CMS did confirm that, you know, that's what it expects, but they would not really explain the numbers too well. They didn't explain, for example, whether that the spending figure included diagnostic testing, you know, monitoring for adverse events, that sort of thing. But still, you know, the drug cost, which is about $26,500 a year, you know, would be expected to be the majority of the estimates. And the numbers just don't add up. So it's really unclear, you know, where they got the number. I checked with Eisai and they said that they had not been in contact with the agency about these estimates because they didn't think it was appropriate. So in the end, you know, it could have been a mistake. It could have been CMS's attempt to drum up concern about the upcoming costs. You know, in the end, my takeaway was that if nothing else, this shows how worried CMS is and continues to be about the level of spending that Medicare is facing for these Alzheimer's drugs.
Yeah, and you know, one of the reasons we talk about this, because you know, everyone in Washington throws around estimates for everything, and we all know what kind of, you know, math is involved in that, and how they never, you know, a lot of times they don't end up being remotely close. But
yeah,
you know, but the problem is these numbers influence policymakers, and you know, like you said, Kathy, they get people thinking and speaking publicly and pressuring people about this potentially breaking the Medicare budget, and then, you know, I mean, we saw it with Aduhelm when an estimate came out for that one, and you know,
right.
And it never materialized, but that was probably a different reason than, you know, what potentially could happen with Leqembi. But I mean, it's easy to see why there's a lot of questions. And, you know, of course, I just want to say up front, I'm not an actuary. I've never played one on TV, so I have no idea what's going on here. This math is well above my pay grade. Are Eisai and CMS just putting different things into the formulas? I guess I'm trying to figure out how they could be that far off. Was it 2 billion off? I mean, that's,
it's hard to know because, you know, as I said, CMS didn't want to explain, you know, how they arrived at their estimates. It's possible that they were using older numbers maybe that had been thrown around earlier, you know, before Leqembi or earlier in Leqembi's sort of life cycle. And they weren't, you know, as up to date on what Eisai is saying now. I mean, Eisai announced in early March that just 2,000 people had been dosed with Leqembi and that they're hoping for 10,000 by the end of this year, but that's going to be a challenge. And the numbers that you know, the $3.5 billion would appear to be assuming something like 100,000. So the numbers just seem, yeah, as you said, they seem so far apart. You know, just on the idea about these kinds of concerns influencing policy and other things. Remember when CMS announced the big premium increase for Medicare back in, I think it was 21, and citing Aduhelm as one of the sort of drivers behind this big increase in premiums for everybody, Biogen cut the price for Aduhelm in half. So they did accomplish something in, you know, with that exercise. And who knows, you know, maybe that's part of what was going on here. It's just hard to know.
Yeah, I think the biggest Aduhelm legacy on the reimbursement side is this whole CMS push on the need for a registry and those kinds of things for Alzheimer's drugs that are still in accelerated approval. Obviously, the accelerated approval products, which we're going to need to be in clinical trials to get reimbursement, and then sort of kind of once you get full or you know, regular approval, as the FDA says, you get to be reimbursed as long as you're on a registry. And that's obviously sort of kind of a hoop that patients and providers have to jump through. And also, as you've written about, Kathy, this is not a small molecule solid oral dosage product that sort of kind of comes in a little amber pill vial you can get at your pharmacy. It's not like a doctor can sort of kind of have a conversation about cognitive decline with a patient, sort of kind of grab their prescription pad, and then sort of kind of off to the races in terms of sort of kind of a reimbursement fight. It's a very complicated drug to administer and even to decide whether or not someone should get it. And we've written some stories about sort of kind of the infrastructure to sort of do the screening and the infusions and all that may not be there. And sort of kind of the reimbursement for the screenings is sort of kind of still up in the air. So it's not just sort of kind of that there's sort of kind of there's one simple trick that ASI has to do to get to that number. There's a lot of various moving parts that have to sort of kind of align if they are going to meet this more alarming estimate for Medicare. But Medicare seems to be taking it seriously enough that they're putting that big number out there.
Yeah, and that's a good point about the coverage requirements and restrictions. That was certainly a landmark thing in Medicare. It is true. My sense is that the registry requirement has been watered down enough that it almost takes a back seat to the complications involved in diagnosis and, you know, the infusions, finding infusion centers, just, you know, finding neurologists who are sort of up to speed on this whole thing. That, as you said, the infrastructure seems to be a real issue at this point. And I think that will... ESI is, you know, working on that. They're working on a blood test that could be a screen for, you know, people who are eligible to be treated. And that would take some of the burden off PET scans. And they're working on a subcutaneous injectable version that would allow for home administration. And that would be a big advance too. But these things are all down the road. Again, you know, will probably really help sales, but what CMS is talking about for 2025 does seem pretty unrealistic.
Yeah, you talk about infrastructure. I think I wrote something about this maybe a month or so ago about how the neurology practices that are able to, that are actually administering the drug have long waiting lists and if you happen to get in off the waiting list, there's no guarantee you get the drug because they go through several steps to kind of assess if you're an appropriate patient and so forth, because they're using the clinical trial inclusion criteria. And then if you get through all that, and then you have to make the decision to do it, which is not an easy yes, And then after that, then you do it. And then, you know, and then they have questions of, you know, there were still questions of like, and I can't remember if this is, I don't know if this is Leqembi or not, but there were questions about like how long you give the infusions. Do you give them in perpetuity? You know, I think with one of them, I mean, there was, you know, how do you, you know, it, some of them have to be exactly every couple of weeks or 3 weeks, whatever it is. And there's like, well, what if I vacation for the winters in Arizona and I have to fly back to Baltimore to get my, do I fly back to get my infusion? You know, what am I supposed to do? Do I skip it? You know, can I not go on vacation for longer than, you know, 10 days? So I could, you know, I mean, it, like, there's still like these kinds of logistical questions that need to be answered. And yet here we are talking about, you know, this rocketing up, you know, spending. So,
right. Yeah, it's true. And then there's safety too, you know, which is
exactly. Yeah.
So,
So where, Kathy, where do we go from here? I mean, I assume there hasn't been any talk about like, you know, like you said, premium increases or, you know, I mean, is this a number that like the CMS, like go back and revisit this, you know, if every few months or something, or is this just like a, we did a study, here's the number and that's it. That's the end of it.
You know, it was not a formal announcement from CMS. So it's hard to know where we go from here. I mean, I assume, you know, we continue to monitor what Eisai says and their experience, but I'm not anticipating CMS coming out with estimates. You know, again, it offered those estimates to help insurers with their bids, and that's an annual process. So I'm sure they'll, you know, revisit that next year. But whether there'll be something further this year, it's really hard to say. My guess is the information will probably come from the company and not CMS.
Yeah, it's very interesting. This will be a really, really fun issue to follow, just to see how these numbers change. I'm sure they're going to change as we go here. Thanks, Kathy. Next up is former CDER director and FDA principal deputy commissioner Janet Woodcock. Dr. Woodcock spoke with our colleague Sarah Carlin Smith about what she's doing now that she has retired from the FDA. Woodcock said she's advising the Haystack Project, which is a rare disease nonprofit and advocate. She plans to help with rare disease drug development, including navigating the delicate balance of determining how to craft drug development programs without jeopardizing their ability to get to market. Woodcock says she is focusing on science, not advocacy, and does not intend to directly interact with the FDA through her work at Haystack or other rare disease groups she's advising. So since Janet left the FDA, part of the little parlor game amongst us here in the FDA press corps is, what is she going to do now? Lots of people have been speculating, and it's been all over the place, you know, from just her going back to gardening to, you know, even, you know, something like this, to all kinds of, I mean, you could pick a job, and I'm sure someone's linked Janet to it at some point. But what do you all think of this move to, you know, to kind of work in the rare disease community?
Well, it certainly fits with, you know, much of her high profile efforts at FDA. And, you know, it's a truly recognition by her that these are very complicated issues and you know, deserving of you know, the best efforts possible. It's a very Woodcocky and puzzle, if you will. It's her kind of balance a lot of
that's a new word.
a lot of different things, and it's critically important. And you know, definitely look forward to seeing her kind of what she can come up with, and you know, how she's able to balance all concerns with this, just like she balanced things in her various FDA leadership roles.
Yeah, apparently there is a rather large gardening project that's also going, but I mean, you know, like Matt, I agree. I mean, you know, working in rare diseases made a lot of sense just because of what she did at CDER with helping to approve rare disease treatments, sometimes controversially, but also, you know, just having been to a lot of the rare disease events where she was a regular speaker, she, you know, she talked a lot about, at least, you know, years and years ago about, you know, telling rare disease groups, get your registry going, get it going now, so you're ready when the you know, when the drug is available, you know, is about ready to be tested. You know, she was really into kind of making sure the groups understood kind of what went into drug development, so they could have their patient, the patients lined up and have, you know, the date, they like the historical control data or whatever it was, you know, ready to go. So you didn't have to wait extra, you know, additional years gathering that once you had a candidate come through. So yeah, it makes total sense that that's what she's working on now. I knew she said she doesn't want to interact with the FDA, but I still wonder if someday we'll see her sitting in the audience at an advisory committee, because one of the treatments that a group she's worked with is, you know, is under consideration. And, you know, I don't think she would speak or be like one of the experts or, you know, speak in the open public hearing or anything like that. But I think we'll see her kind of on the White Oak campus for one of those meetings at some point.
That would be fascinating. I'm less inclined to I might take that bet, Derek. I suspect that she's genuinely retired from FDA stuff. Obviously, there's her, I there's sort of, you know, waiting periods and all that in terms of her kind of you know, what she might be able to do with these things. But you know, I think she's probably has enough respect for FDA to kind of leave it behind in that way. And your idea of her kind of her showing up and her kind of being in the back of the room and everyone like, did she nod? Did she smile at that comment? Like, that would be a fun bit of criminology to add to you know, sort of kind of advisory committee coverage. But I don't see that happening. But you know, I'm not clairvoyant, so we'll have to see. It'll be fun if it does.
They'd have to add a camera that's only on her face the whole time for the live stream.
Get like the Oscars when right before they announce.
Yeah, exactly. Finally, we're going to look at vaccine development. Bridget, you wrote a really nice take on how federal officials are preparing for the next generation of pneumococcal vaccines. So what did you find out?
Well, one of my big drug development themes of the last few years has been the resurgence of vaccine development, big vaccine development for big markets. So these are not rare disease indications. We are talking about, in this case, you know, pneumococcal vaccines. These are not new products. The first pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, Prevnar 7, came out in about 2000. And we've just been seeing sort of these leapfrogging incremental advances that are sort of refreshing the markets. You know, it's not just the pneumococcal vaccines like this story about Merck's V116. It's been very much in respiratory syncytial virus vaccines, pentavalent meningococcal vaccines, which are taking two different products that were approved and trying to combine them into one. GSK just announced the submission of theirs earlier this week. I think it was Pfizer's Pembrolizumab was approved last year in the pentavalent meningococcal space. So there's quite a lot going on. And one of the complications of vaccine development is that you don't just have to get past the FDA, you also have to get a recommendation from the CDC. And the CDC's Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices is the body that does that decision-making or discussion. And they have been wrestling with these just increasingly complicated recommendations, especially for adult use of vaccines, which sort of, you know, makes sense because, you know, there's a big difference between a 35-year-old and a 65-year-old. And there's another difference between a healthy 60-year-old and a, you know, ill 50-year-old. So these are getting to be complicated recommendations that really rely on shared clinical decision making, which is when the CDC decides that individuals might benefit, but they don't see that there's a broad benefit if it was made available to everybody on a population level. People are not always thrilled with the extremely detailed shared clinical decision making. So that is all sort of coming together with what should be what I believe the kids would say would be a baller of a June meeting of the ACIP, where they will be discussing, if approved, Merck's new 21 valent pneumococcal vaccine known as V116. They also, if it is approved, will be looking at Moderna's mRNA contribution to the RSV vaccine lineup, potentially, and increased use of the RSV vaccines in adults who are not in the 50 to 59 year old year age range with risk factors. So that meeting should be very interesting. And one of the things they will be talking about, provided it is approved by its 17 June user fee goal, is Merck's V116, or sometimes known as PCV21, because it's 21 valent. And the interesting thing about this vaccine is that Merck specifically selected the strains to be the ones that are most commonly seen for in adult pneumococcal, invasive pneumococcal disease, whereas the other PCVs on the market really are looking at both, trying to be both children and adult applicable. Merck's done a lot of interesting surveillance to drive the development, select these serotypes. They've got a big epidemiology study for which they developed or are using Merck developed serotype specific assays that sort of give a better look at what serotypes are out there and what are included and how that affects what's included in the vaccine. So that that should be a really interesting meeting, assuming this is approved. It'll be not just about that, but also looking at, about the Merck product, but also looking at the tea leaves of that in pneumococcal vaccines. There's still higher valent candidates in late stage clinical trials, including a GSK 24 valent that's ready for phase three, couple of vaccite candidates. So, you know, this is this issue and these debates are not going away anytime soon.
It was interesting, Bridget, how you brought up rare diseases. To my mind, they're sort of, obviously, the products are very different. So we're kind of talking about sort of, kind of a population wide indication for a vaccine, and then sort of kind of a vanishingly small number of potential patients for some of these rare disease treatments. But for companies, the surety of reimbursement is perhaps sort of some of the appeal to both of those tracks, and they obviously sort of take different paths. But the ACIP as a determinant of whether things go sort of get sort of kind of those federal thumbs up in terms of sort of formulary coverage and the other programs is an interesting binary approach that sort of kind of you don't see sort of kind of with other products, or given the fractured insurance system in the U.S. And so it is sort of kind of a much higher stakes moment sort of after the regulatory approval for companies. So it will be a great meeting to watch.
That's a really interesting point, because the ACIP isn't just looking at specific products, but there is such a huge infrastructure of safety surveillance once these products get out there, using, the different models and different, highly advanced mathematics. When you've got these products that are being used so widely, where the especially where the individual benefit is not exactly clear all the time, you've got to be really careful to be able to find those, you know, three or four cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome that could signify an actual problem.
I still find it fascinating that FDA can give an indication it doesn't marry up with what ACIP wants to recommend. And I know, you know, I kind of understand why that happens. You know, FDA is not going to say, well, this vaccine can only be used for, you know, make it up 65 and older, because they know that's what ACIP is going to recommend, or, you know, and then a year later have to go back and look at it again because the vaccine needs to be used by, you know, everybody else. So they approve it for 18 and older and let ACIP say, okay, yeah, anyone can get it, but we want it for this group, that group. But then you end up creating all this confusion because like we saw with the RSV vaccine. So I don't know why they don't, I wish they married up better. I guess they probably can't.
Well, I think they have different sort of statutory responsibilities. And, you know, FDA does not regulate the practice of medicine. So they can only say, does this drug, is it safe and effective for this proposed use? They can't say that's a stupid proposed use and nobody should do that. ACIP is a qualitative, and they're looking at, you know, their grade model, which is a very transparent, you know, looks at equity issues and it looks at cost of effectiveness issues and access issues and all these things that FDA can't take into account.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I guess I'm, you know, America kind of figured out what ACIP was really during COVID when they were doing the COVID vaccines, and we didn't see a whole lot. We saw some, I think, disparate, you know, recommendations with FDA and so forth, but it wasn't like this where people are like, what am I supposed to do? I have no idea. It's interesting. They got two different remits, and so they're not always going to fit together. But another thing, Bridget, that I thought, and this is kind of a little bit off the subject, but there was a mention in your story about pneumococcal disease is changing now post-COVID. And I'm guessing that that is not the only infectious disease that is adapting to what happened to the pandemic, whether it be to humans, whether, you know, there was no flu for like a year because nobody stood within a few feet of each other for that long. I wonder if this is like, I'm assuming this has got to be like a larger kind of research question for NIH or CDC or whoever, you know, just kind of looking at, how these diseases are changing and what we need to do.
You know, they've really been, and, you know, this is also has been a big issue with RSV, especially with sort of running these pivotal trials, that the seasonality was disrupted. So I believe it's the RSV recommendations, maybe it's the PCV too, currently don't specify what time of year to give it, or, you know, sort of leave that up to the doctors, because you know, the spikes aren't there anymore. But everybody sort of assumes that eventually it will settle back into, and then they will go back into a recommendation to get this in, you know, the fall or however they do it. But the surveillance capacity at CDC and its partners is really quite amazing.
They even talked about it with RSV vaccine, I think, in the context of if we're giving it to infants or we're giving it to, you know, pregnant women, and we're pushing the first infection off a year to like the first to like year one of life or year two of life, is that impacting, you know, the, you know, health and public health and so forth, and how do we deal with that problem? And, you know, that's kind of like one of the unseen consequences, if you want to call it that, of mass vaccinations like this, is that, you know, all of a sudden the disease either adapts or it moves on somewhere else, or like you said, it doesn't come on like it's supposed to, or like we're used to seeing it. So, yeah.
Yep. Yep, you always got to be reacting, and then you end up with very complicated shared clinical decision making recommendations because you've had to address all these little fires. And
yeah, exactly. Well, thanks, Bridget. It's always good to hear about what's coming up, especially in this space.
Certainly, lots of activity.
Well, that's all for today. For more, check out our website at www.thepinksheet.com. You can also find this and other podcasts on the Sightline channel in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Spotify podcasts, as well as smart speakers if they are your default podcast provider. By the way, shout out to all the riders racing in Indiana University's Little 500 this weekend. Godspeed and keep turning left. Thanks again for listening to Drug Fix. I'm Derek Ingery with Kathy Kelly, Bridget Silverman, and Nielsen Hobbs. Take care, and we'll see you next time.